You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it looks like there's going to be a vote tomorrow in the House over formally sending the articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. We'll talk about the latest developments. First, on New Year's Eve, we did a segment on new vehicles to watch for in 2020. Many of the most anticipated models are electric cars, with General Motors, Ford, Tesla, Porsche, and Volkswagen all releasing new models. We didn't plan on spending the entire segment talking about electric cars. That's what happened. So we wanted to bring our guest back before too long to cover the non-electric varieties coming on the market. If you missed that conversation, by the way, you can listen at WPR.org. Among the highlights for non-electrics include a big change to the Corvette, the return of some familiar vehicles of the past, and a new SUV with a starting price of less than $20,000. Jamie Page Deaton is the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. Jamie, great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Big picture, before we start talking about individual models, Jamie, how big a year this is shaping up to be for traditional, i.e. non-electric vehicles?
Well, I mean, right now, the 2020 is shaping up, you know, to be a little bit less than the highs in terms of sales that we've seen from, like, you know, 2015, 2016. And that's simply because there was a lot of pent-up demand in the years following the recession. Now, for most buyers, that and has been met. So we're starting to see sales level off and decline just a little bit. But the big trends still remain. People want SUVs. They like them big. They like them expensive. Automakers are coming up with some innovative and kind of flexible ways of getting people into cars that they might not otherwise be able to afford. And so really, you know, the industry kind of marches on.
What are those innovative and flexible ways to get people into cars they can't afford? I'm curious about that.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of ways. One is they are lengthening loan terms, in a lot of cases, upwards of 80 months. Now, if you're a personal finance person, you know what a terrible idea that is, because you're going to owe a lot more than that car is worth for most of the lifespan of that car, which means that if you get into an accident or you need to buy a new one because the car no longer suits your needs, it's going to be very difficult for you to get out from under that debt. Other things that automakers are doing is they're offering a lot of leases on cars. Now, leasing can be a great way to get into a new car if you like to always get a new one every 2 or 3 years, you don't drive too many miles. But like in the long run, when you're thinking about personal finance, leasing a car means you will always have a car payment. You won't ever own the car outright. And so you really have to, you know, when you're considering these things, you have to ask yourself, you know what, if I have to extend the loan, you know, past 3 years, or if I couldn't afford to buy this car and so I'm leasing it instead, can I really afford the car? So that's something to keep an eye out. There's some analysts who think that there's a little bit of an auto financing bubble going on in the industry right now.
And staying on the point of affordability, the used car options are out there. And I wasn't really familiar with this. I understand a lot of car makers have their programs where they have guarantees for their own models of used cars.
Yes. So they have, most automakers have a certified pre-owned program. And if you're looking to kind of thread the needle between a new car and a used car, a CPO car can be a great way to do it. Because what happens with a CPO car is it's from the automaker's own brand. It has to be accepted into the program. And so that means that they usually have lower miles and are from a newer year than, you know, the typical used car. And then the dealer will inspect it. You know, they always tout how many inspection points that these, you know, that these CPO programs have, but it undergoes rigorous inspecting, and then it usually comes with some extra warranty coverage. And that warranty coverage varies by the automaker. And then there's some other, some extra perks that you can get with a CPO car as well. So, you know, free service for the first year or two. And I should say not free service, but free scheduled maintenance, because there's a difference. And then also, you know, free loaner car, roadside assistant, things like that. Now, you will pay more for a CPO car than you would a straight used car. But if you're somebody who, you know, wants a used car, but is a little bit worried about kind of that reliability question, a CPO car can be a great way to kind of put your mind at ease. And actually at U.S. News, last year we did the best CPO programs, and we found that Lexus was the best one because they offered the, you know, the right balance of perks and mileage and inspection points. So you can go check out at cars.usnews.com and see, we have a breakdown of all the different CPO programs from each automaker to find the one that's right for you.
Talking to Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team, looking at car trends and the models coming out in 2020. You can join in with your questions for Jamie about particular types of cars hitting the market at 800-642-1234. got to get that four in there. 800-642-1234. Jamie, let's start naming some names. The Chevy Corvette Stingray, name with a lot of history there. A big change coming from General Motors. What's up?
Yes. So this is a huge change from an iconic nameplate from Chevy. And what they've basically done is they've taken the Chevy and they've made it a mid-engine sports car. Now, what that means is instead of the engine being in the front, as it is with most cars, or in the back, as it is with, you know, the Porsche 911, they've moved it to basically the middle of the car. So it's right up behind the driver in the passenger seat. And what this does, I mean, the benefit other than, you know, a little bit of an interesting amount of trunk space in the front where the engine used to be, it gives the car almost perfect balance. Because if you think about the way that a car corners, and just think about how you swing a hammer, right? If the weight is in the front, you know, when you're swinging the hammer and you're holding it by the handle, it can get a little bit out of control the harder you swing it. Now, if that weight was moved to the middle, it would be a lot easier to control. And that's what you see. And this is something that brings the Corvette in line with a lot of other sports cars and, in fact, a lot of supercars. It just won the North American Car of the Year award. And it really, frankly, deserved it because this was I've driven this and it is truly makes the Corvette really, it gives it the performance chops to back up its iconic name. I mean, the Corvette's always been a great car, but there have been a couple of generations for it where it was really just kind of coasting on the name. That's not the case anymore. You could take the Corvette to the track and put it up against the best European supercars, and it would hold its own.
Here's another one with some name history for a less good reason. The Ford Bronco discontinued a while back after the infamous O.J. Simpson Bronco chase. This is back in the 90s. Now, it came off the market. Was it because of the O.J. thing, or did it just happen to happen at that time?
It just was a coincidence. Okay. I mean, it kind of ran up against, you know, not only the OJ thing, but also declining consumer interest, you know, raising gas prices. And the Bronco used to be a really old school SUV. It was body on frame, basically a truck with, you know, a nice back seat and a covered cargo area. The new Bronco, Ford is promising that it's going to have the same off-road chops, but you can expect it to be a lot more comfortable on road. That doesn't mean that it won't work. If you want to go on a low speed car chase throughout LA, that what'll probably do just fine for that. But it's one that I think there's a lot of interest in just because it's got that iconic name and some early shots that Ford has released of the Bronco. Now, to be fair, it's covered in camouflage, so you can't get a lot of detail. But it looks like it's going to be, you know, in the same tradition of the original Bronco, where it's going to be very straight, very squared off kind of Tonka truck looking model. And so I know it's got a lot of enthusiasts, you know, myself included, very excited about it.
I'm not an auto industry insider. Is a low-speed LA car chase a standard benchmark?
You know, I'm sure that's part of the auto manufacturer's testing. You know, they'll get a white one. They'll get a friend of theirs to drive them around slowly and see how it goes.
Now, we don't always think of SUVs as being cheap. Chevy is trying to come up with a lower-priced one under the $20,000 mark. Tell us about the new Trailblazer.
So the Chevy Trailblazer, and this is another one that's reviving an old name. It's just because, you know, a lot of automakers like to do that because they can easily build on nostalgia and name recognition. This is going to be, I think, a really tough needle, you know, for Chevy to thread. And that's simply because SUVs, when they start to cost below $20,000, you can really start to tell. And what I mean by that is because you have to spend, you know, so much on the extra steel and the extra materials, the insides start to look a little bit, you know, a little bit less appealing than it might look on a car because a car is a lot less expensive to build than an SUV. Now, that said, the subcompact SUV market where you see cars like the Mini Countryman, where you see things like the Honda CHR, this is a really hot segment because buyers are really enjoying it because if you're somebody who, you know, maybe is downsizing, but you're used to the high seating position of an SUV, a subcompact SUV makes a lot of sense because you don't have to pay for all the space you don't need, but you still get the seating position you're used to. So that's really what Chevy is betting on, that they can get in, you know, people into the SUV who are maybe trading down from something larger, or people who, you know, grew up and learned how to drive on SUVs need something, you know, a little bit small, need something small, but still like how an SUV feels. And so they can get them on their way into the SUV market, and maybe later they'll trade up to something larger.
Now, how about, Jamie, those people who want something that is not an SUV, just an old-fashioned, you know, car, we used to call them. Are they still making those? Are there new ones coming out on the market?
In a word, no. I hate to disappoint you. There are some cars coming out, but the fact of the matter is that consumers have largely moved away from cars. Domestic automakers have moved away from cars. Ford has stopped building them. Chevy has stopped building them. Dodge, and they no longer make cars now. But what we have seen, though, is the brands that have stuck with cars have seen a lot of success, because basically everybody who maybe was going to go to Chevy and buy a car, they're now going to Honda and they're getting a Civic, or they're going to Hyundai and getting an Elantra. And so if you were going to look and go, buy a Malibu, now instead they're buying a Kia Optima. So the brands that have stuck with cars have seen, some benefit from it. But that said, overall, the entire market is just so SUV focused right now, and automakers are more than happy to give consumers what they want, which right now is SUVs.
We're talking about what's hot with new cars and what's not in 2020. With Jamie Page Deaton. She's executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. We covered electric vehicles back on New Year's Eve. We're focusing on the rest of the market now, the cars, if they're out there, the trucks and the SUVs, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in the market for a new vehicle? What are you looking at? What are you thinking about? Or a used vehicle, for that matter? Do you have a question for our guest about what's out there, the names you've seen on the market? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the new vehicles coming out in 2020. Jamie Page Deaton is our guest, executive director of the U.S. News Best Cars team. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in the market for a new or used car, truck, or SUV? Is there one you're particularly interested in? Want to know what our guest thinks about it? What are the most important features you look for in a vehicle? What questions do you have about what's coming out this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll bring on a caller now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I have a 91 Park Avenue, and I have a 2002 Buick Century, and I just bought a 2009 little Subaru Forester SUV. And the little SUV rides like a buckboard, and my Buicks ride like butterflies on a cloud. So I can't say that the comparison of the ride is the same, so I'm kind of sad to hear that they're taking away the butterflies and giving me the buckboards.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Now, I've heard, Jamie, that the Forester with, I think, all-wheel drive does ride a little, tight or something?
Well, I mean, I think, but I want to clarify it. I'm so thankful for Cindy for bringing this up. Most people will say SUV and they mean things like the Forester or the Bronco. And then they'll also lump in things like the Honda CR-V or the Buick Enclave. And really what we mean are crossover SUVs. Now, an SUV used to mean that it was built on a truck platform. Crossover SUVs, though, that's what you really want to shop for if you're looking for that smooth butterfly-like ride, which, what a great description right there. But because those SUVs, so if you take like a Buick Enclave, that's based on a car platform, or if you look at a Honda Pilot, something like that, they're going to drive much more like cars than the Subaru Forester is. And so you can get kind of the best of both worlds. Now, what you'll be leaving behind is the ability to go very far off-road, which I think for most people, what they're really looking for is, better traction in the snow, maybe a little bit of extra ground clearance, but they aren't going to do much more than a dirt road. So in that case, an all-wheel drive crossover is great. But just know when you're shopping, ask, is this a crossover or is it an SUV? Because a lot of people use the term, myself included, will use the terms interchangeably. And so you want to make sure you're getting something that works, great for you.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jamie, I think a lot of times back in the day when we say SUV, we'd often use the adjective gas-guzzling SUV. Is that still the case? Do they still get particularly worse mileage than comparable cars might?
Well, they're still going to get worse mileage because they're going to be heavier, right? They're going to have things like all-wheel drive systems and that extra row of seats, and gas means, or more weight means you use more gas because there's just more to haul around. Now, that said, though, they're not as bad as they used to be. So, and you can even get some really good hybrid SUVs. So, for example, the Toyota RAV4 Hybrid has that, all-wheel drive, smooth, comfortable ride, lots of safety features, good cargo space, and it gets 40 miles to the gallon combined. So you can really kind of, find an SUV or crossover. that works really well for you, depending on what you're looking for. And honestly, too, you can even get some if you're really looking to have an SUV but want to reduce your carbon footprint even more. You can get a plug-in hybrid SUV. Lincoln just put out a plug-in hybrid Aviator. And so you can plug it in. You can get around 20 miles on electric charge alone. And then when you're out of charge, the gas engine kicks in.
Let's bring on another caller now. Tier 2 is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Tier 2, hi.
Hi. I'm a fan of my 2003 Honda Pilot, but the truth is it's not going to last forever. Does the guest have any opinions on late model used Honda Pilots, please?
What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I think I agree that your 2003 Honda Pilot's not going to last forever, but if anything's going to come close, it's going to be the 2003 Honda Pilot. No, the Honda Pilot, the newer ones, they just did a redesign about 3 years ago. It made it an SUV that is a lot more comfortable. The 2003 model was a little bit truckier. The new model, since the redesign, gets better gas mileage, has a smoother ride, and still has fairly decent reliability ratings. So that's definitely something you should look at. Also consider a Toyota Highlander, which is basically a direct competitor to the Pilot. And then also take a look at the Hyundai Santa Fe. That's one that I think a lot of people, particularly if they've been lifelong kind of Japanese car buyers and they just look at Honda or they just look at Toyota, they forget to look at Hyundai and Kia. And Hyundai and Kia in the past couple of years have come out with products that are as good as, and in a lot of cases better than, what Honda and Toyota are offering.
Tier 2, thanks for the call. We'll go to Holly with us now in Sheboygan. Holly, hello.
Hi. I drove Blazers for years, and I'm talking back years and years. And then I went to a little Chevy Aveo when the gas prices were very high, and I drove that for 8 years. And when we started looking again, I had talked to a lot of friends, and they all bought Subarus. They did buy the Outback, but when I went looking for a new vehicle, I got behind the wheel of my Forester, and it was like my Blazer, only better. And I don't understand the bad ride the lady was talking about earlier. Now mine is a 2016, but I'm telling you, I wouldn't go back to anything anymore. I'd stick with my Forester forever.
All right, Holly, some Forester love there, Jamie.
Yeah, and I think there's basically, I think there's two types of people when you're talking about drivers. There's some people, like Holly, and I would count myself in this camp because I drive a Toyota 4Runner, which is anything but smooth. But they really like a ride that feels a little bit more mechanical, where you can feel what the car is doing. And that means that, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of noise in the cabin, and you're going to feel every little bump in the road. But there's something to that, that for me at least, makes you feel a little bit more connected and makes you appreciate the car as a machine. Now, then there are other buyers, like Cindy, who like a more smooth ride that kind of floats you along. And, I have to say, there's definitely a place for that. So the test car that I'm getting in tomorrow is a 2020 Volvo XC90. And, I live in D.C. I commute every day in my 4Runner, and I'm really looking forward to a smoother ride for a couple of days from the Volvo, just because the potholes really do knock you around a little bit. So it just comes down to personal preference. And, when you're buying a car, just make sure on your test drive that you know the area and you find the absolute most torn up street that you can and make sure that you can, that you can tolerate the ride on it.
Holly, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jamie Page Deaton from the U.S. News Best Cars team, looking at the cars out in 2020. Rick is with us in Boscobel. Rick, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Rick?
Wondering about the new Jeep Gladiator truck, how good you think that is.
The Jeep Gladiator, Jamie.
So I absolutely love the Gladiator because it's basically three cars in one. I mean, it's a truck, it's an SUV, it's a convertible. And to my mind, that saves you money because you're buying one car instead of three. It just won the North American Truck of the Year award, was announced in Detroit just on Monday. And honestly, I think it's an absolutely great truck. Now, I also think it's super duper expensive. Jeep knows what they have there, and you can expect. And, the sticker price itself is already pretty high. And Jeep dealers are, putting a premium on it. But for the money and that Jeep feeling that you get when you can, take the roof off, take the doors off. And I have to say, Rick, particularly if you live in like a rural area where maybe you need a car to take your trash to the dump in, or you're looking for something that's great for tailgating, something that's great for, fishing, something like that, I think the Gladiator is an excellent choice.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rick. I want to take a couple minutes, Jamie, before we're done, to talk about some of the other vehicles that have you excited for 2020. There probably won't get to everything, but what have you liked so far? What are you looking forward to?
So I'm really looking forward to the new Land Rover Defender. This is kind of a very old school looking SUV, and Land Rover is one of the few automakers that manages to balance both great on-road performance with excellent off-road performance. And it's got that, you know, upright boxy look that for me is really appealing. I'm also looking forward to the new Cadillac Escalade, because that's one that hasn't been redesigned for a while. And Lincoln, with their Navigator redesign 2 years ago, really just put a shot across Cadillac's bow with how good the Navigator is. And this is something of a, you know, do or die moment for Cadillac, because they've really seen, you know, a lack of sales successes in the past couple of years, and they're really depending on the Escalade to pull them out. So I'm really excited to see how that goes. And then I'm also really excited for the electric Mini. Absolutely love Minis, and to put an electric motor in one of those, because they're so much fun to drive, and electric motors give you all that torque on demand, and you combine that with the really zippy handling of a Mini. And I just can't wait to get behind the wheel of one.
And Jamie, in our last few moments, if we're not super excited about the shiniest, newest thing, is there a good 2019 model out there we should still be watching for?
Oh, absolutely. There's plenty of good 2019 models out there. I would take a look at the Hyundai Santa Fe, and really also take a look, if you need three rows, the Hyundai Palisade and the Kia Telluride. They were new last year. They're three-row SUVs. They're coming from brands that most people associate with affordability, but I have to tell you, I've driven them into, you know, the valet stands at luxury hotels, and the valets absolutely love them, which to me, you know, is a sign that, okay, this is a good car. So...
That's always have the valet take it for a test drive. Good advice,
yeah,
Jamie.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking to Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. We talked through about cars and new car features coming out this year. We also had Jamie on back on New Year's Eve to talk about why 2020 may be a big year for electric vehicles. You can listen to that conversation, learn about the electric cars and SUVs on the market. Find that at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the latest impeachment developments now that it looks like the articles indicting President Trump will be sent to the Senate soon, possibly as soon as tomorrow. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, kids can learn empathy from live theater. Check out new research that shows the benefits of in-person dramatic performances for school kids. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now we're seeing some movement following Donald Trump's impeachment by the House. This morning we learned the House plans to vote tomorrow on formally submitting the two articles of impeachment to the Senate. One article for abuse of power, the other for obstruction of Congress. That follows weeks of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hanging on to those articles, in effect delaying the start of a trial of the president in the Senate. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
First, let's talk, Susan, about the back and forth between Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. People thought the Senate trial would follow pretty quickly on the impeachment. What was behind this delay? What were the issues at stake here?
Well, it seems to me, and I agree that I also thought that it would be done by now, but obviously I was wrong. Speaker Pelosi decided to hold on to the articles of impeachment after the initial vote in mid-December. And what she was trying to do was ensure that when it got to the Senate and there was a trial, that certain conditions, let's say, were met. Now, I'm not sure that the conditions that she wanted to be met, that in terms of how the trial was run, have been met. But I think that there was increasing pressure on her to move the process along to the Senate, not just from Senate Majority Leader McConnell, but also from members of her own caucus.
Speaker Pelosi was on ABC's This Week over the weekend saying she had always planned to send the articles to the Senate. She justified, and this follows on what you were saying, holding on to them this way.
What we did want, though, and we think we accomplished in the past few weeks, is that we wanted the public to see the need for witnesses with firsthand knowledge of what happened, documentation, which the president has prevented from coming to the Congress as we review this.
As you're saying, Susan, we don't know that Speaker Pelosi will get that we will see witnesses. We also don't know that we won't see them as of right now. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So there still appears to be up in the air whether or not there will be witnesses called or not. The Republicans have some witnesses they might like to call. The Democrats indicated people that they would like to see called. So, but it appears that votes on whether or not there will be witnesses will not be coming immediately, but will be coming later.
Another possibility came up. Some Republicans in the Senate had wanted to move to just straight up dismiss these charges without even going through any kind of trial. It looks like that's probably not going to happen. What was the back and forth on that?
Yeah, I read Senator Lindsey Graham made a comment today, I think, that you need 51 votes in order to do anything, and there were not 51 votes in the Senate that were willing to go ahead and dismiss. As late as this weekend, President Trump was suggesting that he would like the Senate to just move forward and dismiss. There were discussions throughout this process that potentially that would be an issue, but there were at least a handful of Republican senators who were unwilling to go along with that.
We've seen some Republican senators say they want the trial and they want to maybe hear witnesses. Some allies of President Trump said, no, don't dismiss this. The president would be better off with a trial. It would look more like vindication for the president if they went through a trial and came to a vote afterwards. Is there a political argument to be made there?
You know, I think that everyone is trying to read the tea leaves. And I mean, we don't have a lot of history here, right? There's not a whole lot that we can go back on. And people who remember the Clinton impeachment have ideas that it hurt him. Some say it helped him. Some say it made no difference. So I think that everyone is trying to figure out what that perfect sweet spot is in terms of what is going to be most beneficial, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, a Trump supporter, a Trump opponent. And I don't know that honestly anybody knows.
Talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, about the latest on impeachment. A next step now, as we were saying, the House likely to vote on sending this over. And then this kind of unique role for a member of Congress, they're going to select impeachment managers. What do they do?
So impeachment managers are what we would, I think, consider as prosecutors. And so the managers that are selected or appointed by Nancy Pelosi will then serve as the team that will present the case for impeachment to the Senate.
How important is that role, or has it been in our, well, I guess, two previous impeachments? I know that's a small sample size, but how important is the selection of these impeachment managers?
Well, I mean, I think it's important, but I also think that it's pretty obvious who they're going to be. So during the Clinton impeachment, there were 13. I think people are thinking that in this impeachment, it will be a much smaller number. The 13 during the Clinton impeachment were all members of the Judiciary Committee. And it just made sort of logical sense to appoint those people, and they had different tasks throughout the impeachment process. What I'm reading now is that certainly Adam Schiff, who is not on Judiciary but is the head of the House Intelligence Committee, is likely to be the lead manager, and then perhaps Jerry Nadler, who is the chair of the Judiciary Committee, also obviously very important in the impeachment process, would be managers. And then from there, there's just been a lot of speculation. And I guess we'll learn tomorrow or maybe later tonight. But as of now, we don't know who those others will be.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talked to reporters today, laying out what could happen if the Senate receives those articles maybe as soon as tomorrow.
We believe if that happens, in all likelihood, go through some preliminary steps here this week, which could well include the Chief Justice coming over and swearing in members of the Senate and some other kind of housekeeping measures. We hope to be able to achieve that by consent, which would set us up to begin the actual trial next Tuesday.
Some other housekeeping measures could come up with a lot of ground. The Senate has to agree on the rules they're going to use to do this trial, right?
Right.
And what kind of things go into that? What kind of decisions have to be made?
Well, I mean, there's decisions on, you know, on procedures. There could be the decisions made as far as when and if decisions would be made about calling witnesses and length of time for speaking and, you know, all sorts of, like you said, the procedural things that will help guide moving forward. People have made a big deal about, during the Clinton impeachment, how the agreement was unanimous and the Senate moved forward with unanimity on what the rules were going to be for the trial. I think I'd be surprised if that happened. What we know is that to this point, the Democrats have not been involved in developing the rules, and that's different from the Clinton impeachment. Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader McConnell, has been working with the White House on sort of what the procedures would be, and he's presented them to his caucus. I believe that was today. But the Democrats aren't really in the loop in terms of what those are. And so I think that if you want 100%, you know, consensus, it's probably best to include everyone in the conversation. So I'm assuming that we're not going to get that.
Talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at the latest developments in the impeachment and trial of President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it was a good idea for Speaker Nancy Pelosi to hang on to the articles of impeachment for a few weeks, likely to hand them over to the Senate as soon as tomorrow? Was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell right to not budge on setting rules for the trial and promising that witnesses could be called? Do you want to see more witnesses, maybe some voices that we didn't hear in the House hearings? If so, who? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation on the latest impeachment developments with UW-Whitewater Associate Professor of Political Science, Susan Johnson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think witnesses should be subpoenaed, called in to the Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump? If so, who would you want to hear from? Do you think this is something that should move quickly through the Senate one way or another? Or do you have questions about the process? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, what kind of names are being bandied about for people who might be called as witnesses if the Senate takes witnesses?
Well, I know that the Democrats have asked about Mick Mulvaney, who is the acting chief of staff, and people who work in his office. I believe that the attorney general's name has come up. I believe others higher up. I mean, and from the Republicans' perspective, they're throwing out names like Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and someone else who's come to the fore more recently, which would be a very interesting witness, in my opinion, is John Bolton. And he had been the national security advisor, and he was someone whose name appeared prominently during the impeachment hearings in the House by other people who had spoken to him, or who had been with him during various parts of all the goings-on with Ukraine and the follow-up of the aid and things like that. So he had originally, back at that point, indicated that he would not appear. And then just recently, he came forward and said that if subpoenaed, he would, in fact, appear as a witness. That then led President Trump to initially indicate that that was fine with him because Bolton knew nothing. But then subsequently, President Trump indicated that should John Bolton testify, that he would exert executive privilege.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hey, thank you. I totally think this historic moment is an entirely Democratic partisan effort to promote their agenda. I think this impeachment thing is a bunch of disgruntled State Department people who didn't like the policy change in Ukraine, and I think there was no crime committed. And I really want the Republicans in the Senate to dispatch this thing as quickly as possible, and I totally support President Trump, and I plan to vote for him this November.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, that's going to be up to the Senate ultimately to decide whether a crime was committed or whether the behavior of the president, even if it didn't constitute a crime, is an impeachable offense.
Right.
Can you talk about what they have to consider there?
Right. And so we've heard quite a bit impeachment described as a political process, and it very much is a political process in the sense that they don't have to prove commission of a crime in the way that a trial would, you know, the standards of evidence and things like that. And but I think that a lot of people feel, as Jeff does, that this was motivated politically and, you know, support the president and want to see this come to a quick end.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. We'll go to Chris now in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
So there was only two points. One, I think that Nancy Pelosi hanging on to the impeachment articles didn't work to her favor. I think it allowed Republicans to frame the conversation, kind of putting the ball in their court, which I'm not sure if that was the best idea. The second comment that I had was, in any type of criminal proceedings where there's an indictment and you go to court where you have two lawyers, a judge, and a jury of your peers, in any type of those proceedings, you would always be able to call witnesses. So I think the ability to call witnesses in this type of situation is kind of built into our perception of what a justice system looks like.
Chris, thanks for the call. To that second point, Susan, some people have made the analogy the House impeachment is like an indictment by a grand jury, then the Senate trial is like a criminal trial. Not a perfect analogy, but Chris is saying, following up on that, that would imply that you should have the ability to call witnesses as you would in a trial. Is that an argument that people are making?
That's definitely an argument that people are making. I think that that's the simplest way to explain what the process is, but I think that it doesn't fully explain the process by using that, although I've used it many, many times. you know what I mean? But there's more to it. And again, getting back to, first of all, I mean, the role of the Chief Justice. He certainly isn't in a role of judge as we would view a judge in a regular criminal trial, for example. And then there's many other ways where it's not analogous to a trial.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Time for one more caller. Mario is with us in Black River Falls. Mario, hi.
Yeah, good evening. I have so many things I want to say, but I know I have to keep it short. you know, our judicial system today has been made a mockery of time and time again. I don't believe that we should be even following through to fruition on this. That's just my own personal opinion. I have been I've been in combat. I'm a war veteran. I've seen the results of countries that failed to provide for their population. We are, however, are not one. We do have a lot of issues with due process and whatnot. We also have a lot of issues with the border, you know, so on and so forth. Hunger here in the United States, although it might not be rampant in our area, but nevertheless.
Mario, I'm going to jump in because you just have a few moments left. But the argument, I think there, Susan, that the impeachment is a distraction from more important stuff. That's been an argument certainly from the president, among others.
It's been an argument from the president. I think it's been an argument from some Democrats who feel like they'd rather be focusing on other issues, and they've come back and showed how they have been focusing on other issues. I think that there's probably some Democrats who are going to be on the stage tonight debating who wish that we were talking about things besides impeachment. So I'm guessing if you talk to most people, they would like to see us be thinking about other things.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mario. In our last minute, Susan, I won't ask you to predict what's going to happen because who could, but what are you focusing on over the next week or so?
I'm focusing on the issue. I'm focusing on the vote procedurally to see whether or not there's consensus. And then I'm going to be focusing on what happens in regard to witnesses and what sort of agreements they're going to make about whether or not witnesses are going to be called. And I'm always watching the president's Twitter feed.
And you'll have a lot to talk about with your students in this coming term, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Susan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We talked there today about the latest impeachment developments, including a vote likely tomorrow in the U.S. House over formally sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Once things get up and rolling in the Senate, we'll have a lot of live coverage from NPR here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin saw its wettest year ever last year, and scientists say climate change is driving more frequent, intense storms. As Danielle Kading reports, heavier rains are making it tougher to keep untreated sewage and stormwater out of the Great Lakes and state waterways.
30-year-old Connor Andrews loves swimming. He especially loves swimming at beaches like this one along Lake Michigan. At a lakefront coffee shop not far away on a cold winter day, he says it's unlike anything else.
It's an amazing feeling, a lot more so than jumping in an inland lake. And it's soothing mentally to come and enjoy Lake Michigan.
But he has to check conditions before jumping into water that may be polluted by stormwater runoff or sewer overflows. Parts of the city and region rely on combined sewers that collect stormwater and sewage for treatment. But increasingly heavy rains can overwhelm them. In 2018, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District saw 6 combined sewer overflows, the most events since 1999. They sent 1.2 billion gallons of stormwater and untreated sewage into waters that drain into Lake Michigan.
It's when you get 2 inches of rain in 20 minutes that it overwhelms the sewer system.
That's district spokesman Bill Graffin on his way to the Jones Island facility. It's one of 2 plants that treat wastewater for more than 1 million people. Once there, it's a 3-minute ride in an elevator to reach an underground pump station. These pumps move water from the district's deep tunnel up into the plant for treatment. Graffin says the tunnel can store 521 million gallons of waste and stormwater until it can be treated and released.
Our goal is always to capture and clean as much of it as we can. Occasionally you can't. Our biggest priority during a storm is to prevent basement backups. And the only way to do that is you open up the relief valves in the sewer system.
Milwaukee isn't the only city struggling with sewer overflows. Data from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources shows the rest of the state saw the most overflows in 2018 since 2010, releasing 150 million gallons of waste. And Milwaukee and other communities released millions more last year as the state saw its wettest year on record. Senior scientist Steve Vavris with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison says climate change is driving Wisconsin's record wet conditions.
And so when we do get rain or snow, it tends to be heavier than it used to.
More intense storms are stressing sewer systems as local governments are struggling with upkeep. In 2012, Wisconsin's roughly 600 publicly owned wastewater systems reported they need to invest more than $6 billion to meet federal water quality goals. That includes Ashland. The city saw 15 million gallons overflow into Lake Superior during one weekend storm in June 2018. Ashland Public Works Director John Butler says more than a third of its sewer pipes are more than 50 years old.
And the rate of replacement and repair over the last recent history hasn't kept up with the rate at which it's aging.
The problem plagues communities across the Great Lakes, a drinking water source for 48 million people. By mid-century, Milwaukee could see up to 20% more untreated waste flowing into waterways without changes. That's according to Sandra McClellan, a professor with the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She says increasing storms could drive poor water quality.
And when it happens in spring and during the swimming season, that's when people can be exposed to that water.
In one extreme case, a cryptosporidium outbreak sickened around 403,000 people around the Milwaukee area in 1993. The rash of illness followed heavy rains. Experts speculated human sewage and animal waste may have been the source. The city has since invested millions to guard against exposure, but other communities may be vulnerable. Both Milwaukee and Ashland are making investments to address their sewer systems and using green infrastructure to capture rain with the hope they can prevent more waste from entering the Great Lakes. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at President Trump's rally tonight in Milwaukee, the Democratic presidential debate also tonight, and why Wisconsin is likely to play such a huge role in deciding the general election in November. Also tomorrow, an ER doctor gives us the inside story of the emergency room with the tough choices and the overwhelming workload that can be a regular part of the job. And back in the age before freezers, ice had to come from outside somewhere. We'll crack open Wisconsin's history of ice harvesting. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, a lot of people are exploring their roots and looking for potential health risks by getting their DNA tested. But that's raising concerns about what happens to that information, who gets to see it, and what they get to do with it. Explore the frontiers of genetic privacy. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then free trade agreements have taken a lot of heat in the last few decades. We'll talk to a former U.S. trade official about why he thinks they're a net positive and how the government could better offset some of the downsides. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.